Mini episode 212 of the FDH Lounge is brought to you by DOU Productions, delivering coverage of sports and pop culture through columns, live blogs, and original videos. Follow them on the web at generationshatter.blogspot.com.
The FDH Lounge. You want to schedule your life around it.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to FDH Lounge, mini episode number 212. This is FDH managing partner Rick Morris coming at you today, welcoming back one of our favorite guests for talking policy with, public policy, very timely on the heels of this big election that we just had this past week. The gentleman that we have on with us today is a former congressman from the state of New York and somebody who is one of the foremost activists in our country on the subject of the federal debt, intergenerational theft, and the like. And he is an expert in a lot of different areas as far as dealing with this. He is uniquely qualified to speak on the subject as somebody who was involved in working on the New York City bailout back in the 1970s, the SNL bailout at the end of the 80s, and somebody who has, again, looked at all these issues, written about them long before they achieved the prominence that they have in the last 10 years or so, as our national debt has just exploded. And he has been steadfast on the subject. Although he is somebody who was in public office as a Republican, this is very important to point out that he has been consistent in speaking about this, regardless of whoever's in office. One of the primary criticisms we have on this show as the kind of partisanship to where Republicans don't care about big spending when George W. Bush is in office and only care about it when Obama's in office, and vice versa. Democrats are obviously the same way. This gentleman is steadfast and consistent on the subject. I speak, of course, of our friend, the great Joe DiGuardi. It's a pleasure to have him back in the FDH Lounge show. Good to have you on today, sir. How are you?
Hey, Rick, what an introduction. Nice to be back. And by the way, I not only was going after George W. Bush, I was there because of Ronald Reagan's coattails. Don't forget, I'm a Republican that was elected in a Democratic district, and I went after him because he had a $200 billion deficit in 1986-87. So this, you're right. This is not just a Democrat problem. This is a Republican, a Democrat problem. And for 40 years, we've been kicking the can down the road ever since Lyndon Baines Johnson changed the budget process to a tricky thing called a unified budget so he could use the annual surpluses in Social Security as they were building up to reduce the deficit, to artificially reduce it. So,
Joe,
and here we are, 40 years later, not talking about $100 billion or $200 billion, $1 trillion for 4 years in a row, just a deficit. So the national debt on the books is $16 trillion, and off the books, if you added all the entitlements, it's well over $60 trillion. Unbelievable.
Oh, absolutely. And you know what? That's a great point. As far as trying to get our arms around where we're at right now in this process, right after the election, they're going to be dealing with the fiscal cliff coming up. And it's the same set of characters, House, Senate, and presidency, as far as who's in charge. But I want to go back for a second. This is something I've said on the show previously. You mentioned Ronald Reagan. I'd like to test my theory against your experience, because you mentioned that about Ronald Reagan and the big spending of the 80s. And I know that, again, with the Democratic House, it always struck me that he was making a lot of these compromises with Tip O'Neill to get his defense spending there at the end of the Cold War. My sense is our opportunity that we had that was lost was when George H.W. Bush was president, because it seemed to me that would have been the time to get off the trajectory. We were going to be having the peace dividend in the Defense Department, and it would have seemed like you could have gotten off that Reagan trajectory for spending in the 80s. It never happened. It only kept going up. Am I right in thinking that
but,
that
you
was
know,
our
that's
opportunity
a very,
was blown?
That's a very cogent, smart comment, and I accept that. But let me go back to Ronald Reagan for a minute, because, you know, it's the accounting stupid. I guess it was Carvel that said it was the economy stupid. I'm saying in my book, Unaccountable Congress, it doesn't add up. It's the accounting, stupid. Ronald Reagan, yes, he was spending money on defense. He wanted to bankrupt Russia. But a lot of what he spent on, if we had a capital budget, would have been put as assets on the books. Unlike Jimmy Carter, who most of what he spent was governmental programs that were annual expenses. But you're right. On the one hand, Reagan was tagged as a big deficit spender, but if the accounting was right, he wouldn't have. But going to George H.W. Bush, you know, you made a very good point, because by that time we had bankrupted Russia, we built up the military, and at that point we could have done a lot to start saving for a rainy day, which we haven't done. But you can blame every president down the road, and the worst offender has been George W. Bush, putting two wars off the books and spending like a drunken sailor when he was supposed to be a fiscal conservative. So, you know, we set it up so that when Obama came in, he could blame Bush, you know, for setting the trend for just spending in order to get us out of the mess. But it's a mess that, you know, we were put in, not by any one president, but for many, many years, exacerbated under George W. Bush, and then, forget it, on steroids under Barack Obama, because in the last 4 years, the deficits haven't been less than $1 trillion. And in 1 year, it was $1,600,000,000. So that now we got not only a fiscal cliff, we got something else coming up, Rick. You know what it is? The debt ceiling, $16 trillion something. They're going to face it probably in January or February. And now we're going to see who's got the nerve to stand the ground and say, you know, I'd rather go bankrupt, theoretically, than keep kicking this can down the road. But that could be a problem because the rating services will come in, and then we'll see all kinds of other things play out. But you know what? At some point, we got to take a stand. And this country, the political system is broken. You can see in this last election, you know, I don't care whether you're a Democrat or Republican, to me, it's a damn shame that it wasn't as competitive as it should have been. Obama, first of all, should never have been president to begin with. He was a community worker, a senator for 2 years, and because of the terrible experience we had under George W. Bush, he was at the right place at the right time. His rhetoric was perfect, hope and change, and he got to be president. But in my mind, he didn't deserve another 4 years. Look at the record. But was Romney the best candidate? No. I mean, for the message he had on health care, on Wall Street, on taxes, he was not the best candidate. They went after him with those super PACs, and I'm surprised he came as close as he did. But frankly, if he didn't have all those problems, he would have won in a landslide.
Absolutely. And this is what we like about you on this show, Joe, because, again, I myself am a big fiscal conservative, but I get branded a heretic for not being a party line guy. It's very refreshing to hear you backing up a lot of my points on this stuff and George W. Bush and all the things that really helped kind of put us in this spot here. And it's one of those things where, again, as long as we're slaying sacred cows, the one thing that I know a friend of yours, Ron Paul, has talked about, and I'm a big believer in this as well, while we're putting the sacred cows out there, the Pentagon needs to be audited, and Grover Norquist, to his credit, has recently endorsed that as well. This is a thing, Joe, where, again, we're borrowing from China and other sources for just about everything we're doing right now, and we certainly owe it to ourselves to make sure that there's not any waste or bloat in there, and I think you'd have to be a fool to assume that there's not at least some in the Pentagon. So, you know, this is a thing where the Republicans are they're crying about the sequester coming up, and, oh, it's going to do this, and it seems like they only believe in Keynesianism when there's defense industry jobs at stake here, you know? And it just seems like, again, we can't afford to have these sacred cows.
I'm with you. I remember what Eisenhower said, watch out for the defense establishment with the defense, you know, the military with the defense companies. He warned us back then. And then we get to Congress when I was there, and, you know, I saw the waste. We had a gun. And we were screaming and yelling to eliminate it. It couldn't hit the target. I think it was called the Sergeant Howie gun or something. You know, once you get a government, a defense program going or a munition system, it's very difficult to shut down. The military knows how to lobby, and they think we are a bottomless pit when it comes to the money. I remember at my time, my 4 years in Congress, we had Peter Grace. We had the Grace Commission. He had hundreds and hundreds of pages. It was a whole chapter just on the things we could eliminate line by line in the Defense Department. And I'm sure, and that's one of the reasons, by the way, I would have wanted a Mitt Romney as opposed to a Barack Obama, even though he didn't create the kind of jobs that he claimed he did. He was really restructuring companies. He was a CEO. He was the kind of guy that could dive in to the numbers and look at the line items like Peter Grace wanted. That's where the waste is. It's not on the surface. It's underlying all these agencies, all those line items, all those budget expenditures, and someone who understands the accounting for these things, and we would have started to reduce it. So I'm with you. I don't think we need to increase defense spending one bit. I think if we did look at what we're spending, how we're spending it, how it's being mismanaged, you'd find that there were ways to save money on defense without endangering our national security.
Oh, absolutely. I think that's a very common sense point right there that unfortunately not enough people really grasp and really look into it. While we're slaying sacred cows, I said something nice about him in the last breath here, Grover Norquist. But again, you and I are both fiscal conservatives. Neither one of us really likes taxes. But this whole thing, I hate taxes personally. I hate them as a matter of public policy. But if you believe in the Laffer curve, again, taxation at 100% doesn't work. Taxation at 0% doesn't work. You got to find the sweet spot. The Republican answer to everything has been tax cuts. George W. Bush's tax cuts, a couple of his were Keynesian, just mailing back checks to people willy-nilly without any sense of what they were going to do. Again, when there was talk last year or the year before about would you accept the 10-to-1 deal of cuts to the tax increases, and no Republicans are going to touch that, you can't convince me, Joe, that we're not at the part on the Laffer curve where you couldn't bring in some more money on this. And if Republicans don't have the guts to get in there and really tackle entitlements head on, and it's clear that they don't, they got to pay for it.
Well, listen, you're saying the right thing. I just got off the phone today. Two of my former colleagues, Tom Talkie and what is the other guy's name? It goes back a while, but let's see. Tom Talkie, I served with him. I didn't serve with the other guy. And they have something called Fix the Debt. And they asked me today whether I would sign on as a former member to this approach, a balanced approach to deal with the fiscal cliff and the deficit. And on that is tax reform. There is no question that we have to start off, and I think this is where the Republicans are today, and that's what I heard Boehner say to the Democrats, hey, let's get around the table. If you guys are willing to start talking about changing the entitlement formulas here and maybe raising the year a couple of years like we did before, we're ready to start talking about the revenue side, but we'd like to see it folded in a comprehensive tax reform package where we get rid of the loopholes and come up with pro-growth things and reduce the tax rates and increase taxes that way. And I think it's possible. So I wouldn't say we're just going to increase the tax rates on any one group. We got to look at the entire Internal Revenue Code. But there's no question we need a combination that raises revenues and reduces expenses. And at the same time, we got to look at the trajectory on the national debt over 10, 20 years and the entitlements. This is a big issue. I hope we're going to tackle it the way we should. People are getting smarter about this. So I don't think you can hide this by taking just a year-to-year approach anymore. It's not working.
Absolutely, yeah. It's got to be a fundamental reworking of it. I agree with you. Tear it up, start over, get in there. What I worry about, though, as far as being able to do this in a way that's actually going to work, you'll look at one of my favorite political reporters, Tim Carney, the way that he really kind of chronicles this iron triangle of big government, big business, big labor. You've got big business and big labor both with their snouts in the trough of big government here. Are the lobbyists going to be able to kill something like this? Everybody wants to keep their loopholes. All the special pleaders are out there. You, having been in Congress for a couple of terms, I'm sure saw it up close firsthand. This is a moment that we really need to seize to fundamentally rework everything, Joe. But what kind of a threat are some of the lobbyists and corporations and frankly, labor institutions as well? What kind of threat are all of those to the reforms that we need?
Rick, when I say the system is broken, It's not only, you know, Washington. It's basically money in politics. It's also how we elect people, the redistricting process. We want to know why is America 50-50? Well, we created computers that know how to, you know, divide Republicans and Democrats pretty evenly. And that's the problem here. We got to go back and look at a lot of different things, including electing a president. Why do we need a president with two terms? Why not 1 6-year term? So they do their job, not worry about getting reelected and spending $1 billion and wasting 2 years. We wasted 2 years on this election. And where do we go? After $2 billion on both sides, I understand, with the super PACs, and 2 years, we're back where we started. What's changed? The House is still controlled by Republicans. The Senate's controlled by Democrats. And Obama's still president. Now, I hope that we're smart enough to see that we've got to all sit around a table and make some changes, because the real enemy, Rick, is not here. It's outside our borders. It's China. It's, I mean, talking about economically. South America, Europe. I mean, thank God we're faring better than they are right now. But, you know, China is still growing, and they think they're in a depression, growing at 7%. And we're growing at what? A meager 2% at best, maybe even less. We don't know yet until the next numbers come out. So, you know, we got to stop this business about, you know, dividing ourselves by race, by ethnic group, by conservative, Republican, by Democrat, you know, liberal, you name it. The real thing is our real party's America. And if we don't start competing the way we should with the rest of the world, or to compete, we got to be strong. And to be nationally secure, our economy has to be strong. So there's a lot that we have to start going back to fix. The lobbyists are just one part of it. These are people who are just in it for money. That's why I never became a lobbyist. I am, by the way, a registered lobbyist for human rights, because I'm a volunteer lobbyist for human rights for the Albanian people in the Balkans. I started that in Congress. I started a 501c3 Albanian American Foundation, a 501c4 Albanian American Civic League registered lobby, and we have a PAC, the Albanian American Public Affairs Committee. I don't get paid. My wife doesn't get paid. But we're doing it as lobbyists because we know that you need a voice on certain issues. Well, we're not doing it for money, but 99% of the former members who leave get a job in somewhere in Washington for money, and that's how they live, and they live pretty large from what I've seen. Now, I don't want to criticize any individuals, but that's there, and we got to change it somehow. But you know what? The worst nightmare for the lobbyists on Wall Street just happened in Massachusetts. Elizabeth Warren got elected. Scott Brown is out. So obviously their lobbying and their money didn't do what it was supposed to do.
Exactly. And Karl Rove's, you know, billionaire donors for Crossroads GPS, they didn't get banged for their buck in the presidential race and a lot of the Senate races as well.
Rick, so much money has been wasted. Don't tell me, I never bought this idea that, you know, money is speech. Negative speech is free speech? Come on. Most of what we spent on these PACs was negative speech. Where did we go with that? That destroys people. It destroys candidates. And my feeling is it poisoned the system. But for all the Republicans that are listening to the show, I can only say what I've said to my friends who called me after this disappointing election at the presidential level. Don't despair, because the House is still controlled by Republicans. And under our Constitution, Rick, guess where spending bills, taxation bills, and budget bills have to emanate from?
The House.
The House. So that's still a very powerful place to control, and I believe they still control it by about the same amount. Maybe they lost a few seats. I didn't see the final count. So, you know, it's still – the Republicans are not out of the game. But can we sit around the table with reasonable people from both parties and start saying, you know something? We got to worry about the next generation besides our own generation, because it is taxation without representation. The debts we're running up are going to force us to raise taxes on people that are not even born. That's the problem. It's intergenerational inequity, and that's the accounting system we have. That's the budget process. By not putting all these liabilities on the books, we're fooling ourselves, and we're stealing from the next generation. Read my book, Unaccountable Congress. It doesn't add up. When I did it in 1992 after leaving Congress, Rick, what did I put on the cover? A credit card in gold, and I called it My voting card is the most expensive credit card in the world. Same size as your Visa card is our voting card in Congress. And what did I put on that gold card? Expiration date, never. Bill to future generations. Credit line, unlimited. And when I redid the book, when I ran for the U.S. Congress, Senate in New York State, not a good place for a pro-life fiscal conservative, but I ran, and I put another card on it, the national debt card, a Visa card, shaped like another, you know, national debt card on the backs of the young people. So I haven't changed my method, and I haven't changed my message, as you said in your great opening, one bit. And by the way, I don't sell those books. You can buy it on Amazon. It goes right to the foundation, Truth in Government. So I'm not one who's on trying to, you know, sell a book here so I can make some money. Anytime we get any money on those books, guess what happens? I print 10,000 copies to give away at colleges and universities and at seniors at high schools. I speak around the country. Look at my website, Truth in Government. Look at the speech I gave down at Wharton to 250 students and their professors, the PowerPoint. And you could see really what's wrong with America. And why am I doing it? To wake up the young people that were spending their money. And it's wrong.
Absolutely.
It's morally wrong.
And
we got to stop.
And I hope they appreciate it. I know I certainly do. I'll tell you, Joe, I've had an ongoing friendly, civil disagreement over the course of the show with one of our cast members here on the program, who is actually an elected Republican official and somebody who, frankly, is much more of a believer in the system at this point than I am, and somebody who does, on First Amendment grounds, insist that money equals speech. And I always say to him, I don't have a perfect rejoinder to that because, again, I don't believe in public financing. I believe in the First Amendment. And it's been my theory for a long time that it'll be almost like the political equivalent of the cure for cancer when somebody figures out how to crack that code. Do you have any ideas on that, on how we can dim the power of the special interests without, you know, repealing the First Amendment or anything like that? I know that McCain-Feingold proved to be unworkable the way that it went, and new loopholes were just created along the way. Do you have any ideas whatsoever on constitutional ways to decrease the influence of money in the political system?
Well, the first thing we should be doing, which is very much in tune with common sense in our Constitution, is transparency. Why do we hide any donations? Why are some people, even in these super PACs, putting them through what you call IRS tax-exempt organizations, not exempt as charities, but exempt as 501c4, social welfare lobby groups, and therefore they don't have to then publicize the donor. Anytime, I remember when I was in Congress, there was a group called GOPAC. Gingrich started it, and I never knew until I left that the reason they had that as a 501c4 was that they could take the donations, even though there was no tax deductions because it wasn't a charity, and the IRS rules say you don't have to then publicize the donations or the donors. Well, that's what's going on with these super PACs. That's wrong. Let the people know where the money's coming from. If you don't want to stop it, my feeling is it's wrong, that the money should be subject to some limitations like we had under McCain-Feingold. Because otherwise you're not creating a level playing field. People who are poor then have to raise, you know, a tremendous – well, let's go back to the initial reason for this free speech thing, that if you're a multimillionaire, under this definition of free speech and constitutionally, permitted free speech, that you could spend all of your money and your candidate, your opponent, then has to raise money – you know, limited to it's up to $2,500 a race right now. My feeling is that's not fair. Now, if it is free speech, to me, it's not fair. And I think fairness is still a factor in America. Why are we allowing people with unlimited amounts of money to run for office? They don't have to spend any time fundraising. And people who are bright, people who are well-motivated, honest, then have to compete with people like that. Now, maybe they're bright and honest too, but let's say that there isn't that, but money now makes up the difference and gets people elected. So my feeling is that we have to look at that. On the issue of the money equaling free speech and Citizens United, I disagree with that because I think that the speech we're getting is terrible speech. It's negative speech. It's not helping America in the election process, and somehow that's going to be revisited, and it will be. Don't forget, it was a 5-4 decision. 5-4 decisions are known to be shaky, and I think it's going to change when people realize we just spent $2 billion. A lot of it wasn't transparent, and nothing changed.
Exactly, and the odds are that the composition of the Supreme Court will change in the next 4 years. There's a number of justices that could be up for replacement due to age and or health. Just to bring everything full circle, Joe, as we're looking at the situation now, again, you've heard some murmurs out of both sides after the election here. It started with Speaker Boehner. A little bit more conciliatory on both sides than we've seen since things really fell south in the summer of 2011 during the debt ceiling crisis here. Do you have any kind of optimism that in the next couple months we're going to get the kind of fundamental reworking we need?
I do, because as a practical matter, we will fall off a cliff. If you raise taxes and cut spending the way the fiscal cliff is designed, because don't forget why it's there, they didn't do their job, and they just kind of kicked the can down on the road, and we came up with this formulaic approach. That would really damage our economy. The job situation would tank. We would go into a depression. It seems to me, no matter what your ideological view is, you don't want that to happen to America now, and you don't want, you know, us to go into a situation where we would find it very difficult to come out. And I think that's what would happen if we don't come up with some reasonable compromise. And I know the word compromise is not liked by the fiscal conservatives. As long as we know that there are major cuts to be made and entitlement programs will be reformed, we have to put revenues on the table. There's no doubt about it. Without that, we're going to go nowhere.
I certainly agree with that, Joe, and I think any reasonable person would. And, again, we always appreciate your very statesmanlike view on these matters. And we're going to have a number, obviously, of public policy developments in the next couple of months here. And we're certainly going to want to catch up with you again as things warrant, as circumstances change, and hopefully start changing for the better. But we appreciate your time as always, sir. Thank you very much for being on with us today.
Rick, my pleasure. Keep up the good work.
Thank you very much, Joe.
Bye.
Really appreciate having you on today, Joe. Thanks very much, and thank you all for tuning in with the great Joe DiGuardi here, FDH Lounge Mini Episode number 212.
As we bring the show to a close, we would like to extend our deepest gratitude to NBC, CBS, ABC, Fox, All Clear Channel affiliates, TNT, TBS, USA, UPN, Deadspin.com, YouTube.com, YTMND.com, MySpace.com, various blogs, Fox News, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, IamBored.com, Billboard.com, Google.com, ESPN, ESPN2, ESPN News, ESPN Classic, NBA TV, NFL Network, Sports Time Ohio, Athlon Magazine, Comedy Central, Cartoon Network, The Boomerang Channel, QVC, BET, The Spice Channel, Steno Notebooks, Manwich, Papermate Office Supplies, Waitresses, Strippers, Bartenders, Garbage Men, Janitors, Microwave Popcorn, The Writers of The Office, Scrubs, Entourage, My Name is Earl, Oz, Metalocalypse and the Boondocks, Awkwafina, and The Periodic Table of Elements.